Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The margins on serving food in a dining room, served by servers, those margins have never been thinner. Is the restaurant business as a result screwed? I really don't think so, because I think that the value of restaurant brands has never been more substantial.
This week, we are back with Eater and Resy co-founder Ben Leventhal. It's good to have you back, Ben.
Sure.
First of all, let's talk about the history of reservations at restaurants, because that's something you must have thought of, right? Because you started Resy in 2014, which is after OpenTable. 16 years, whatever, yeah. If I'm doing my math correctly.
Yeah.
So let's talk about where restaurant reservations were when OpenTable started and even before.
Well, yeah. I mean, for centuries, it was pen and paper. It was literally a book, and you'd write down the names of the people that were coming in, and that was really the system that restaurants had. And I was out in Seattle at Canlis not too long ago, and they have
which is a great Seattle restaurant, we should tell people.
And Canlis is one of, I don't know, 10 most important restaurants in the United States, probably. You know more about that than I do, but Canlis has been around, I think, since the 40s.
Yes, and it's reinvented itself many times.
Many times, and it's now this amazing, iconic, beautiful place in Seattle, family-owned the whole way through. And anyway, they have all their reservation books back to the beginning.
That's awesome. You mean like on a shelf?
Yeah, and if you ask, they'll show them to you. And the thing you see in those books instantly is like, I mean, the process of making reservations is whoever the maitre d' is, they write it down. There's sometimes a little note, you know, likes corner booth, or I saw one notation which was mayor of Seattle. And, you know, that was the process for a very, very long time. OpenTable and some competitors, there was about a dozen players
right.
that all around the same time
right.
were
all
doing this.
Right, a whole bunch of startups, and OpenTable emerged as the winner.
Correct.
And there actually wasn't even a second place.
No, I mean, it was, there was a couple of services. I think one was called Dine Time or something like
right.
that.
Right, one Todd English was involved with, I can't remember.
Drew was involved in one.
Right.
Maybe Todd English was involved in one. It actually maps pretty similar to 2014. And when you really look at the articles that were written about OpenTable, the Times has a good archive on this. When you look at the articles on OpenTable from 1998 and 1999, the articles talk about all the competition and all about all the uncertainty around switching to technology.
Right.
And lots of the things that we talked about in 2014 when we decided
formulating
to sort of,
Resy.
You know, update all this stuff, and refresh. But yeah, reservations were pen and paper and entire 100% analog since the dawn of time. In the late 90s, you know, really as the internet got to scale and web browsers got to scale, it occurred to several really good entrepreneurs pretty much at the same time, if we can connect restaurants to the World Wide Web, to the internet, then we could do things like allow 24 hours a day, 7 day a week booking. We can start to put customers into databases that can be searched and that can be updated, and we could start to sort of use technology to update this idea of hospitality, this idea of reservations taking.
Yeah.
It started in very simple ways. I mean, you know, the early OpenTable ideas were very simple. They called it a digital reservations book. It wasn't a platform. It wasn't a service. It was just a digital book.
I've thought about this because you and I have both spent time in the music business. I spent a lot longer in the music business. OpenTable was Ticketmaster.
Yeah, that's what it was.
I worked for a concert production company, and we were doing a show at Carnegie Hall, which seats, whatever it is, 2,700 people. Carnegie Hall kept 3/4 of the tickets to sell at their box office,
yep.
And then the rest were given to Ticketmaster.
There you go.
And that was the model, I assume, for OpenTable.
Yeah, I mean, that was—
Because nobody wants, no restaurateur wants to give up the power.
To this day, even, there's not 100% trust.
Right. Now, still 2/3 of the reservations are still made on the phone.
In a lot of restaurants, that's exactly right. And that ultimately is a result of the fact that restaurants don't trust technology to do the loyalty work that they've got in their head. Who should get which table? Who do I say yes to? Who do I say yes but to? Who do I say no to? that stuff largely is still being done by humans. We're making a lot of progress. And, you know, if it was 75% humans when OpenTable started, I think we're probably now at 75% technology with Resi, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So it's the ability, which is what restaurateurs were so skeptical about, as you just said, to connect hospitality to technology.
Right.
Because they think, oh, you're removing the human element.
Right, right. And in fact, that was, again, I try to be a student of history, at least in this very narrow lane that we're operating in. When you look at what restaurateurs said about OpenTable in 1998, they were talking about how, well, technology can never be hospitality. You're never going to replace the human touch of the human connection of eye contact and a voice and a handshake. And obviously, we now know that that's largely not true. And really smart, you know, folks like Danny Meyer have said, really, the technology isn't, you know, going to remove the hospitality. The hospitality
can be enhanced.
It can be enhanced, and either you're going to be hospitable or you're not. With technology, without technology, it doesn't matter. Either you're,
right.
Either you're going to run a hospitality business or you're not.
So OpenTable, when it started, it quickly got big.
Yep.
It smote all the competition. It went public.
Yep.
The original investors made a lot of money.
Fair to say.
And to the point where in 2014, when Resi was started, Priceline paid more than $2.5 billion for it.
2.6, I think.
Yes, not that you.
I don't know that figure off the top of my head, but I think it was about 2.6.
Yeah. So, and yet, when that happened, is also when Resi, almost to the month, came into being. So what did you learn? And by the way, recently, Priceline has written down the value of that investment.
Yeah, they wrote it down by about $900 million, which I think roughly, you know, equates to the amount of value that we've built at Resi.
Yeah.
So we'll take the $900 million.
Right, right. So, but like, what happened and what made you think there was an opportunity? Like, was it just correctly identifying, you know, reading the tea leaves?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if we were reading tea leaves, but I think that there was two really important things that we were considering. First of all, restaurants evolved a ton since 1998. Restaurants have become, in terms of their merchandise, incredibly diversified. And what I mean by that is, you know, any restaurant worth its weight in gold today is doing pop-up dinners and is doing chef series and is doing wine dinners and has a PDR and runs a bar and does delivery. Restaurants are surviving and thriving today with many more revenue streams, and they're trying many more different things today than they did 20 years
right.
ago.
Right. So mostly out of necessity, I might add.
Because it's out of necessity.
The margins on the restaurant biz itself are becoming narrower and narrower.
The margins on serving food in a dining room, served by servers, those margins have never been thinner. Is the restaurant business as a result screwed? I really don't think so, because I think that the value of restaurant brands has never been more substantial. But, you know, when you ask what did we see in 2014, one big thing we saw is restaurants are just different than they were 20 years ago. They need different technology. There's different opportunities to use technology to drive hospitality in ways that we wouldn't have thought of 20 years ago. That was one thing. The other thing is that, you know, I don't want to pick on OpenTable. I think OpenTable does a lot of things really well. But the technology landscape in 2014 was stale.
Mm-hmm.
There hadn't been real innovation in a long time.
And maybe because it was the lack of competition.
You know, monopolies can often foster lack of innovation, right? I mean, public utilities are not really particularly very innovative. Cable companies. That was the other circumstance that really sort of helped us get Resi off the ground in terms of the market opportunity is there was no innovation. There was lots of obvious stuff. You know, the advent of smartphones had come and gone without really OpenTable doing anything to update the basic ideas of the product. And so you've got in 2014, everybody's using their phone as a remote control for life, for all the different things that they do. And restaurants have evolved substantially in terms of just their form, the form factor of a restaurant. And so we said, let's do this thing from scratch. Let's build this technology. What would this technology look like if we built from scratch today for the modern customer, the modern consumer, and the modern restaurant? And let's go from there and see where we get.
You hooked up with Gary Vaynerchuk.
Yep.
Mr. Social Media. And when I knew him, when I first met him, he was doing his daily video blog about wine from his father's wine store in Madison, New Jersey.
Wine Library TV.
Wine Library TV, wearing a hockey jersey,
Jets,
I believe.
No, Jets.
Oh, a Jets jersey. I knew it. And he was just talking off the cuff, totally unscripted, and yet he developed a really, really loyal following, and then he's gone on to obviously be this social media guru. So how did you two meet, and what was the evolution of the idea?
On the last episode, we were talking about entrepreneurship. The other really important element of starting a company, being an entrepreneur, is having a good team around you, I think. And so Gary and I had been friends since the Wine Library TV days. I met him when I was building Eater and he was doing Wine Library. We had a mutual friend in common and we went to wine dinners and became friends. And our third co-founder, Mike, is an engineer, a beast of an engineer, had just come off of a gig and was looking for opportunities. And so the group came together and said, we've got the know-how to really take a swing at this.
Right. You have the three legs of the stool.
We've got the three legs of the stool. We'd kind of be foolish not to do something here. And so, you know, with the technology, with the restaurant industry expertise, with Gary's, you know, general entrepreneurial expertise and marketing expertise, we said, you know, we're going to see what we got.
And so did you write up a business plan? Did you do the typical entrepreneurial steps? And how did it happen?
Yeah, we did all that stuff. I mean, it was, you know, our initial idea was to help restaurants market prime inventory. And so we did some sort of back of envelope math on how we could help restaurants generate revenue, more revenue at prime time, which was an idea that we're still thinking a lot about. That's evolved a lot. We could talk about that. But we put the basics together. We raised a little bit of money as a seed round and we went to it.
You were making a living from your salary. You'd raised enough money so that you could pay yourself something. Well, you wouldn't go that far.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I was fortunate enough to not have to like draw a salary for a limited amount of
Christ,
time.
Christ, you made some money from Eater, and
you know, I'm not a
you're not
I'm
a high liver.
I'm not ready to retire, but
right.
But I was able to save for 6 months. I'm not going to take a salary.
Got it. And what was the initial reaction? I mean, it's an incredibly you're walking into an incredibly crowded marketplace. Yelp has gone into the business, right? Yelp is ubiquitous, with all the positives and negatives associated with that ubiquity. You've got friends and family money, and you do have a lot of horsepower in the three partners, but it's kind of a terrifying thing to wade into, just as an outsider.
Yeah, where do you even start? How do you break the seal? I mean, yeah, we went to places where we had good relationships. We went to operators who I've known the longest, with whom I've built the most trust. And we said, look, this space is broken. We've got some ideas. Let's partner and figure it out. I didn't knock on any doors and say I have all the answers. I said, here's what I know is not working today.
Help me build something great.
Help me figure out what the solution is.
That will be mutually beneficial.
Correct.
Yeah, so that's an interesting, because that isn't the way most entrepreneurs go into things. You know, they go into it thinking they have the answers. And it's interesting that you guys walked into this not thinking you had the answers, but knowing that there was a problem that needed to be solved.
The core insight that we had is that the restaurant industry is changing and did change and continues to evolve incredibly rapidly. And so the technology has to change. That was really the only insight we had at the very start. We had some ideas around how even though restaurants are now bona fide entertainment, the inventory monetization is the behavior there is different from in other facets of the entertainment business. But we went to restaurants and said, look, this whole thing is broken.
Right. If you agree with that, let's talk.
Right. Exactly.
And so in a way, OpenTable basically created the opportunity in the fact that they were the initial people who tried to connect hospitality to technology. Whether they did it well in the end or now, you know, is an open question. But they paved the way for you guys.
I mean, certainly OpenTable was a pioneer in that they got restaurants comfortable with technology. they're one of many factors that coalesce in at the time we're starting Resi to sort of make the industry ripe for change. But there's no question that OpenTable was among a very small handful of players that got restaurants comfortable with technology.
Yeah, for sure. And so what was the first year like? You know, people always think that entrepreneurial ventures are linear and a straight line to success or failure. But I'd like to hear something about the first year of Resi, because I know that you have done this enough times. This isn't your first rodeo, that you had to expect there were going to be bumps in the road.
Yeah, I mean, it's gruesome. Every day of a startup is gruesome. If it's not gruesome, something's wrong. Something's off.
Then you're being an ostrich.
Yeah. Every day is a battle. I mean, there's something very exciting. I love competition. In all parts of my life, I love competition. I love the opportunity to win and then to win. And,
right. What I discovered at Serious Eats is that it wasn't just about winning. And this is what a friend of Maxwell's from Apartment Therapy told me. He said, everyone loves to win, but it's the people that refuse to lose that make it to the finish line.
No, I like that a lot. I think that that's true. I think certainly in the first year, as the leader of the company, what I had to do was make sure that the lights turned on every day. I think at the darkest moments, I had to keep those things to myself.
Right. And that's the thing. You really need a good poker face. And I had the worst poker face then. I'm incapable. My wife said she could tell by how I put my key in the door what kind of day I had.
Well, look, I mean, you got to understand that you have to have the long view. You're building something from scratch. The people that you're lucky enough to have working with you, the people that will take a risk with you, you know, the first 10 employees, they're taking almost as big a risk as you are. And in some cases, they're taking a bigger risk because they got to trust. All those first 10 people are trusting me that they're going to be able to make their rent. Mm-hmm. And so you have to, that's incredibly important. And you have to make sure that those people feel really almost minute to minute like they made the right choice.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of those little ups and downs that are incredibly exhausting and at times terrifying, you have to shield people from those things. I think that that's part of being a good leader of a startup is making people feel, if you're confident in where you're going, Ed, as the CEO, as the founder, if you know you're going to get there, I don't think you should necessarily have your team worried about the day-to-day stumbles.
Right. No, you can't. And in fact, that was a problem at Serious Eats, was because people were too aware.
I think that there's a balance. You know, I want to be working with, I always want to be working with people, whether it's on the second day that after we got the tax ID number, or it's 5 or 10 years later, I always want to be working with people that I'm proud and confident of being in the trenches with. But at the same time, you know, you want to make sure that they could be focused on the things that they have to do to for the company to be successful. So a lot of there's a long answer to what was the first year like. The first year is about keeping focused, about
and the lights on.
Keeping the lights on, about keeping focused, about getting from point A to point B to point C to point D.
I thought that great press and all this buzz was going to be sufficient collateral for loans.
And that, it doesn't work like that, it
really
turns
out. It really doesn't work that, you know, it's like, but wait, the New York Times called Serious Eats the gastronomic supersite. Okay, so
congrats.
What about your apartment? How about that as collateral?
Right.
And people don't understand that there is no ratio between buzz and good publicity and sustainability as a business.
I think the other thing that people don't understand is that it's really, really hard to
yes.
start a business. You know,
my hair was red when you first met me.
We are constantly reading about the mega successes. When the New York Times writes about business and technology, they write about Uber and Airbnb,
Snapchat
and Instagram. And you know, the Instagram founders became billionaires in 3 or 4 or 5 years, whatever it was. Those are I mean, those are the exceptions, you know.
Yes, they're the 1/10 of 1/10 of 1%.
They're so rare. And people,
they're beyond unicorns.
They're way beyond unicorns in terms of their rarity. And people sort of get into this thing and you get super excited and all that enthusiasm is great, but at the end of the day, I think that sometimes you can forget how hard it's supposed to be.
Right.
You know, when you do really, really well, when these things start clicking, it's almost impossible. And I think that that's okay. I don't have any problem saying that. You
but
know,
it's because you're experienced enough to know that. If you don't know that and it's your first rodeo, like it was with me, it's a lot harder to sort of try to integrate all that data and come out on the other side.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. And I think what I do try to say to people that haven't been through a couple of cycles is you got to understand how hard this is about to be. You know, people say, I want to start a company. I want to do that. I want to go out on my own. And I say, that's great. But, you know, it's really fucking hard.
Right. Right. It's much harder than getting a six pack on your abs. You know, it's like, it's way, way harder. So Resy is now used by 1,000 restaurants.
Yeah.
You're in 80 cities. You just got $13 million. I could say that because it was in the press from Airbnb. So I was going to say, so it's all good. But now, based on what we've been talking about, it's never all good, is it?
Well,
there's no guarantee that you're going to get to the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well, look, at some point, if you're lucky enough to get there, at some point your business, your startup shifts from being in survival mode to being in execution mode. And so we're now in execution mode, and we're very lucky to have gotten out of survival mode intact. But, you know, there's a difference. In survival mode, it's really about what are the things I need to do to keep this thing going to make sure that tomorrow and the week after that, everybody gets paid and the lights stay on. And when you get into execution mode, you have to think about what am I going to do to make sure that we're here in a year? What am I going to do? Am I leveraging my partners as best I can? Am I building the right team around me? Are we building systems that scale? Are we paying the right amount for a new restaurant?
So it becomes a much more executional exercise than a strategic exercise.
I mean, at the end of the day, if I had to whittle all of this down to one single thing that's the most important in terms of being an entrepreneur, I think it's about the ability to execute. If you can execute, you could figure this stuff out. But there is a shift in terms of the life cycle of a startup where there is a noticeable shift in how the business operates. And you have to understand that's a very different kind of business. If we were to operate Resy today, if I were to say that Resy is still in survival mode, I would burn everybody at my company out and we'd go to zero.
Right. It's so funny you say that because we were in survival mode for 8 years.
That's a long time.
It's a really long time, and people stayed because I tried to make it a fun place to work and a place that fostered creativity and let people be their own brands. And that worked out for everybody. But it is a really, really long time to be in survival mode. It's too long.
It's too long. It's too long. And you know, you figured it out. So at the end of the day, like that's the only thing that matters is you did get out of survival mode. But that's the key. When you talk about new partners like Airbnb and growth and 1,000 restaurants, that's the key to the next phase of the business is execution. And the things that I think about are, how do I keep my team engaged without burning them out? How do I keep people challenged? How do I think about the next big, exciting things that we're going to do without getting distracted by those things while we're still trying to execute on other things?
So the pressures and the anxieties change. They don't go away.
But it's a different game. It's yours to lose. It's our game to lose now. You know,
right?
We've put a couple of runs on the board, and
now it's, can we get to the end of the game winning?
The idea that this is a business that could continue to operate.
You have to figure out what success is, and it seems like there's actually only one definition. It is sustainability.
I think you're right. I mean, I think sustainability is certainly, if there's one, that's what it is. But I think success is, you know, I'm incredibly proud of the fact that what we have established is that there's no longer going to be one player in the space. We have gotten restaurants unshackled from their lack of choice. And now restaurants are empowered to make a choice. And it may not be resi, and I'm okay with that. But now restaurateurs know that they have got optionality.
Right.
And that's going to lead to innovation, and that's going to lead to this technology, resi and elsewhere, getting even better. So I think that that's really like, if even if this ultimately this winds up not being a business that is around for
50 years, whatever.
50 or 100 years,
yeah.
You know, those are the kinds of wins that I point to as things that I'm really
sure.
proud of. But certainly, you know, in the end, this is business. Is it going to be profitable or not?
What's on the horizon for resi?
Well, we're starting to play around in international markets.
Mm-hmm.
So articulating a business internationally is something that we're focused on right now. We just acquired a company called Servi, which was a standalone secret shopper and feedback service for restaurants that we're going to be incorporating into our product, which will help restaurants get more visibility on quality control. We're continuing to expand the team to pursue and tune our partnership with Airbnb. I mean, in terms of that partnership, we just introduced booking in their app. So you can open up Airbnb app or you can go on the Airbnb website.
So
and that's a fully native experience on Airbnb.
So your software is essentially becoming open source or more open source to a certain...
Well, it's not open source, but we are very much interested in connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing with Airbnb, in some ways it will be unique and will, in the long run, will be unique. But generally speaking, we are trying to use our technology to create connectivity for the restaurants in a lot of different directions, which is, and so in that way, that's 100% right. We want to be able to connect to anybody, any service, any company, any platform that can help restaurants with their business is something that we want to connect to. And so we think that's another big initiative for us in 2018 is that connectivity.
Yeah. So it's just about time for the special sauce, all you can answer buffet, but I always now ask people to turn the tables on me, no, in your case, pun intended, and ask me a question. This is like our equivalent of ask me anything, because you and I have known each other a long time, and we've discussed a lot of things. Is there a question you're dying for me to answer?
I don't know. Would you do it again?
Would I do it again?
Would you do it? And what would be your answer? What's your answer now? And what would be your answer if I had said at the end of that eighth year, you could get a reset here if you want.
Mm-hmm.
You could go back and you know, you could go, you get reimbursed
before
for the whole
the
thing.
Before the sale,
yeah.
You just get reimbursed. You start at ground zero.
You get to reset. Would you have said yes?
That's so fascinating. Wow, that's a crazy question. My guess is... I really don't know the answer to that question because the stress level had become unsustainable. So I guess if you zeroed out all the debts and everything else and everyone was made whole and I could start from scratch, I think then the answer would be yes. And now I actually don't feel the need, you know, I'm older than you, dude, but like I don't feel the need to do it again. I feel like I've been so fortunate in living a dream, like having a dream about something, about creating a place where people can get information and chew the fat about food-related things from an authoritative yet friendly place. And how many people get to do that? You know, or anything like it. So I don't know. I mean, there's lots of things I want to do and I'm going to do, but I'm not sure I have the stomach to do it again.
You don't have another Serious Eats in you.
No, I don't think so. So, all right, now it's time for the buffet. So in this case, you know, you're so young, man, but like who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Like
well,
it can be living or dead, can be artists, can be musicians, can be directors, can be business people, can be fellow entrepreneurs, can be restaurateurs, can be chefs, can be anybody.
Well, if it's my last meal on earth, I would prefer there are no strangers.
Okay.
But with that said,
right.
I've been thinking about this a little bit recently, just because it's, you know, one of those questions and I would really like, you know, somebody like George Steinbrenner, I'd love to talk to about entrepreneurship. I mean, as you know, I'm a huge Yankee fan. I'm a diehard Yankee fan.
Me too. We're not going to talk about what just happened, but it's been a great year.
You know, that's the party line, at least.
Yeah.
But, you know, I grew up watching the Yankees in the 80s, and there was like a bunch of losing seasons before the late 90s, mid to late 90s. I'd love to talk to him about entrepreneurship and how he thinks about risk.
Right, and he's hardly a perfect hero.
He's hardly a perfect hero, but that guy was willing to risk it all every year.
Yeah.
And you certainly don't see that in his sons.
Yeah.
I like to talk to, you know, somebody like Robert Moses. Certainly Galileo is probably an obvious answer, but these like, you know, big daring thinkers.
Yeah, like builders and thinkers.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I like that. It'd be an interesting table. So
it would be pizza, by the way.
Okay, yeah, so that leads me into my next question. What are you eating?
It'd be pizza, no question about it.
Really?
Non-negotiable, yeah.
So wait, have you been to Raza in Jersey City?
I haven't been there yet.
It's life-changing.
Really?
It's life-changing. You know, Pete Wells asked me to go out there, and then he wrote the review where, like, he used me as a foil in the Times. But it is...
Life-changing?
It's life-changing.
Wow. Well,
so you need to go. You may need to go tonight,
You've just gotten it to the very top of the list.
So pizza, anything else?
Good wine.
Good wine.
Yeah.
Anything for dessert?
Maybe some mint chip ice cream.
Mint chip ice cream. I like it. All right. So... what do you cook, and how much cooking do you do? But what do you cook when there's not much in your house to work with?
I don't cook a ton. I have a daughter who just turned 1 year old. And
wow,
so,
I forgot that. Congratulations.
Thank you. So I'm cooking more now.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife is doing most of the cooking, to her credit. She's a very good cook. Her mother's a good cook, as is mine, of course. I don't do a ton of cooking, but when I'm cooking, it's you know, simple stuff like steaks on a grill with a really good char on them. I like to use a charcoal grill and get a ton of heat on it. Lots of simple olive oil, salt, pepper kind of vegetable cooking.
Or pastas.
Pastas, yeah.
Like garlic and oil or whatever.
I've sort of developed a habit of cooking a frittata on Sundays with everything that's left in the refrigerator. Lots of, you know, vegetables, and even if, you know, we've got potatoes or whatever it is sitting in there, I'll put those in there. So
yeah,
the stuff I'm cooking now is really so that my daughter eats healthy.
Yeah. So it's just been declared Ben Leventhal Day.
Oh, wow.
All over the world. It's a big deal, right?
Yeah.
So what's happening on that day? What's happening on Ben Leventhal Day?
I get to take batting practice at Yankee Stadium.
Okay, that's good. That's good. What's everybody else in the world doing?
I don't know. That's a tough one, Ed. I mean, they're pursuing their passions, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying something they didn't try the day before. They're unshackled from risk aversion, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be daring. They could try something new.
I think that's a great answer. Thanks, Ben Leventhal, for sharing the entrepreneurial roots of Resi. And congratulations on Resi's success. May it continue to be whatever it is you'd like it to be.
Amen.
So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.